time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy. Hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Greetings, cretins. Good to see you.
Good to be back.
Yeah.
We took a little bit of a break there for the holidays, and then a little bit longer break.
And where's the time gone? Yeah.
And we're about a month behind in getting started again.
That's the way it goes when we're having fun, right?
Yes. Yes. And having fun, indeed, we are. This has actually not been too bad with the old pandemic and everything causing all the craziness, but it's actually doing shows a little bit easier for us in a way.
True. Yeah. I haven't had to figure out when, you know, trying to coincide our schedules. It's been a little more regular, huh?
Yeah. And it's allowed us to bring in more friends, you know. People that we normally don't get a chance to see. And speaking of which, we should probably schedule something with our good friend John Blickman.
Oh yeah, I'm sure he'd be happy to do it.
Yeah,
I was just talking to him last week and laying out plans for a BYO boot camp we're doing later this week.
Nice.
And
He's always entertaining and interesting. Always got new things. That's the thing about Blickman Engineering is they're never resting on their laurels.
That's right.
Making the same old thing again and again. They
improve it,
you know, are always improving, always coming up with new ideas, new stuff, new inventions. Everything from the very top end and the professional size system down to the smaller systems and the more automated systems. Right. And then you've got, one of those
Anvil Foundries and
Anvil Foundry, right?
Yeah, all in one, very nice little system. Makes brewing simple.
Yeah, see, that's what I need. I need to run this brewery off of an Anvil Foundry. You've got a 37 barrel size of that?
No, I don't believe so, but I'm sure he could put one together.
He'd probably have it ready next week. That's how good Blickman Engineering is. Check them out, blickmanengineering.com. They are a longtime sponsor, and they help pay for the show, so you don't have to. So please don't miss out on them. We were supposed to have our good friend Martin
Cornell
on today, but due to the time change, we seem to have miscoordinated, because I guess they're not changing their clocks the same time we're changing our clocks in the U.S. now. So we're off by an hour. So hopefully he'll be here shortly and to talk about Burton Ales. But in the meantime, we've got lots of questions from our faithful listeners, and I thought we could knock some of them out.
That'd be cool.
Ron Barnes was asking, hello guys, have you ever brewed with spruce tips? How would you go about using them? I know Alaskan Brewing uses them in their winter ale, and I thought they might be fun to play around with. Thank you for any tips or insight. John, have you done spruce tip brewing?
I haven't. I've had some outstanding spruce tip beers, though. And I believe the way that they are used is basically after the boil, kind of whirlpool additions, hot steeping in order to best extract the resins and flavors without cooking them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of it is I've done some spruce tip brewing, and I've been part of you know, it tends to come out when people are doing some collab brews, or they're doing a big brew day, or learn to homebrew day. People didn't bring them out then. And a couple of things to note. I think you want the freshest little tips possible. Certain times of year, they end up becoming more woody, and you don't get quite the same pungency from them. So they're going to vary, similar to hops, you know, and when you pick them, and you want to get them at the right time.
And other buds, yes.
Certain hops are going to, you know, help with, if you want to accentuate that kind of character, and you go with more of the resiny, piney type of thing. But be careful, because you can overwhelm your spruce tips. Part of the spruce tip thing, I think, is to not, you know, it is to almost as a substitute for hops. So generally in bittering addition, and then, and one of my favorite spruce tip beers was, you know, it always had kind of like an amber color ale.
Oh, yeah.
I think some of that crystal malt kind of goes a little more old school, you know, pale ale type of beer.
Right. I remember having a spruce tip beer at one of the national homebrew conferences, and can't remember which one it was. Might have been Minnesota, might have been San Diego. I think it was Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But I had this spruce tip beer that had an overwhelming taste and aroma of fresh strawberries. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing heavy about it, nothing cloying about it, just a beautifully flavored beer.
And then I think it's the blue spruce that they use for spruce tips?
Various types, yeah. In Alaska, the ones that Jeff uses, I believe, are the blue, or maybe silver spruce up there. You can use several varieties, and but you got to pick beginning of, you know, spring, the fluorescent green tips that are, you know, new growth. Mm-hmm. You don't want anything older, because that's when you get into some heavy, you know, pine flavors that just aren't as nice.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, yeah, I remember also back, maybe 15 years ago or so, maybe, it was, Brian Hunt from Moonlight Brewing. He made a Redwood, beer.
Oh, really?
And he used more like the branches and the leaves versus, you know, just the tips. Mm-hmm. And it was really fascinating. And I really liked it. I thought it was a well-made beer. And then, you know, the Redwood character was interesting. It kind of gave it a bit of a spicy, you know, but green. Yeah. Not as resinous. But I thought that was really interesting. I thought Brian's a great brewer. I thought that really, for me, that was unusual, but so our tips would be, use the freshest tips, make sure, you know, you're harvesting at the right time, use them in the whirlpool or dry tipping, versus in the boil, and, watch your hops, use complementary hops, and, you know, perhaps, the more tip character you want, maybe the less late hops you want to do. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we will have more of your questions right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're doing Brew Strong. We're answering your questions. If you are listening live in the watching on Facebook, in the comments section, you should be able to ask questions, and John is going to try and monitor those for us because we don't have probably Bevo here today, and she will or John will perhaps read your questions live if you're nice and polite to him.
Yep. I just realized that in order to view any questions on Facebook, I have to have Facebook open.
Yes, that would help. Yes. Immensely. In the meantime, I can pull up another question. Paul is asking, how do I properly affix a Celebrator Doppelbock goat on a brew in a bag setup since I don't have a true mash tun? Am I out of luck? Great question, Paul. You know, the Celebrator Doppelbock goat is a critical part of any brewing setup. It is what brings luck to the quality of your brew. And so I always use that. And I noticed that when I put one on my mash tun, I started winning a lot more awards. So to this day, I have a Doppelbock, Eyinger Celebrator Doppelbock goat hanging on a mash tun. Matter of fact, it's hanging here in the brewery at Heretics too. So there's a couple of rules that must apply. First off, you have to purchase the bottle of Celebrator Doppelbock. You can't steal it or something like that. You cannot just take the goat off of one of those things at your local BevMo and hang that on there. That's bad juju. What you have to do is drink the Doppelbock, the Celebrator, and then you hang it on your mash tun. Of course, brew in a bag. I would think you could hang that anywhere on the kettle because that kettle with brew in a bag becomes your mash tun. Isn't that correct, John?
Sorry, I was fiddling with Facebook, trying to sort out the chat feature on it.
Checking what people's updates, what their kids are doing, pretty pictures of cats and dogs.
No. Michael asked dosage rate for spruce tips, for example, if I'm looking at the right comment section. The question you just asked me was?
Brew in a bag where you hang the goat.
Get
right on that kettle because that's technically your mash tun.
Yeah, and I would even, you could tie it to the drawstring of the bag as well.
Right.
If you have such. Yes.
Interesting story. The folks from Eyinger told me we ordered like 25 kegs of Eyinger beer for our Oktoberfest.
Right.
Absolutely delicious. And so the rep came out and I told the rep about this Eyinger goat story. And she's like, she'd never heard of it before. And so I showed her and she sent pictures back to Eyinger about the goat and all this. And she told me that the goat was, they started doing that back in the day to support their local community around the brewery. It was tough times at some point. And so they got the community producing these little goats to put on the bottles.
Uh-huh.
And then when times improved, they were like, okay, we can stop making the goats now. Everyone's like, oh, no. You got to keep making the goat.
Yeah.
So that's how the goat came to pass. It was in support of their community, which is really cool.
That's really interesting.
That's how you put the goat on there. All right. So volume of spruce tips?
Yes. What's the dosage rate? Yeah, he asks.
Well, in 5 gallons, I've seen anywhere from, a quarter ounce of just the tippy tip tips to, half a pound. I've seen some pretty heavy dosages. I think it depends a lot on what is, how fresh it is, how much of a character you want, how malty the resulting beer is going to be. The maltier it is, the sweeter and the more kind of crystal caramel you have in there, the more it's going to suppress that character. So you need to kind of be careful about balancing those two. If you do it in a really pale, light beer that's very dry, it won't take much spruce tips. So it's going to depend on the beer. If you do some big, heavy, dark beer like a Russian Imperial Stout, it takes quite a bit. For a general pale ale, let's say, I don't know, I might start somewhere around, 4 ounces. I like it, my spruce beers to be pretty sprucey. And I think that, depending on where you pick them, it's going to affect things.
That sounds reasonable. Yeah.
You'll go with that?
Yep. Let's see here. We have a question regarding sparging speed. He's at wants to know the reasoning. This is John Granger, wants to know the reasoning behind sparge speed, i.e. 1 quart per minute. What are the pros and cons of sparging slower or faster?
Well, slower, it takes you more time. Faster, you generally get less extract. You get the most extract from a slow sparge. The slower the sparge, the better the extract seems to be. And this is if you are fly sparging. If you are putting water in on the top and you are letting that slowly percolate through, if it rinses through real quick, you may not extract every bit. If you let it sit there for a while, it will extract more sugars from with inside the grains. It will reach an osmotic gradient that across there, and you'll extract more out. So that's the benefit to going slower. I've always advocated going slower. Tends to seem like you get a clearer wort and you get more wort, more sugars. But if you're doing something like brew in a bag, it doesn't really apply unless you're going to, rinse out the bag again. You're going to dunk it in more water. If you did, then you'd want to let it sit for a bit, to extract more versus just bouncing it in, kind of think about it that way.
Yeah.
Hey, John.
Yeah. Grain grist size, in general, the crush size is a factor. The finer the crush, the easier it is to elute the sugars from the grain. And the faster you could theoretically sparge. However, at very fine grist size, it is the resistance to flow through that bed can be quite high. So there is a trade-off there. In general, I think, as Jamil said, the guidelines for sparge speed are you want to go slow enough that you are rinsing the grain rather than risking channeling around the bed or, preferentially through the bed and missing out on a lot of extract in the grain bed. You want to drain or sparge slow enough that you uniformly rinse the grain bed of the sugar that's in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the faster you go, the more likely you are to get some channeling.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Paul, again, of the goat question, also asked, I've been brewing a lime pie gozo with great success. My recipe uses a zest of 5 limes. Mm. Is zesting the limes better than just throwing 5 limes in? I understand the rind is to be avoided as much as possible, but if I threw in the whole lime, would the rind ever get in contact with the beer? That's an interesting question. He's talking about that white pith layer, which is quite bitter.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never thrown in whole limes. I think you might run into a couple of problems. One is the limes may float.
Yep.
Lessening the contact with the skin and the wort. The other is that you might not really extract all of the goodness of the skin because you're not cutting it open. When you take a peeler and peel it off, or if you take a zester and zest the limes, I think maybe you expose more of the cells of the skin.
Get more oil out.
More oil out, more flavor. If it were me, I would just quickly run the zester, across the limes. It's only 5 limes, pretty quick.
Yeah. There've been a couple of orange brews, you know, ales that I've had over the years, various breweries. Very often, just in the for expedience sake, they would crush the whole orange and throw the whole orange in there as a way to speed up the process. And those beers very often had a bitter aftertaste from the rind that you don't get when you zest. So I think if you're looking for that, a nice touch of, you know, citrus flavor, zesting is the way to go. Got a question here from Jimmy Jacobson. He asked, is fly sparge or batch sparge better for a drink cooler mash tun with a stainless braided hose as the filter instead of a manifold or false bottom? And you've always used false bottoms, Jamil, I believe. I've used various. The batch sparging is a very easy way to go, especially with a manifold or a stainless steel braid. The caveat to batch sparging is you have to drain the wort completely. If you don't drain it completely and then refill, you lose a lot of extract. Because you don't get uniform rinsing with a braided hose usually. So it depends on draining all of that first running's wort, which is your highest quality and highest yield wort, before you introduce more water.
I will say one of the advantages to batch sparging and something like that is, you know, when you add the second batch of water, you can mix up the grains again with the water and you don't have to worry about channeling or anything like that.
Right.
It makes it pretty homogeneous, and then, you know, you extract it out. You may not get the absolute maximum possible extract from, you know, batch sparging like that, but it's really close and it's really not a problem. You know, you can always just throw in a little more grain if that's what it takes.
Yeah.
I would use whatever method makes you happy and comfortable.
To continue on that thought, these days I find myself doing no sparge brewing most of the time. Because again, as you say, you just throw in another pound of grain, another, you know, 5% of the grain bill, and you're done. You don't have to sparge. You drain your full boil volume in one go and you're ready to boil.
I will say that no sparge brewing, there's a definite benefit to it where, you know, flavor wise, you're going to get a richer, maltier character, which can be good in some styles. It can be to your detriment in other styles. It depends on if a beer traditionally was sparged and extract a bit more of the tannin and a bit more of that husk and grainy material, that character is part of the style, then you're going to want that. But in general, you get more flavor and a nicer flavor from no sparge, like John's talking about, especially in something, if you can do it in something like a Bock, you know, or certain German lagers, you know, it can be really nice. But in things that were tended to be extracted more, you need to, you want the sparge then. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll have more of your questions right after this.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking live. And if you're watching on Facebook, you can ask your questions there in the comments section. And the lovely John Palmer will... observe your questions and relay them. One of the things we were talking about brewing was a shandy type beer.
Oh.
And got a couple ideas for it, but one of the things is we're going to come up with a name, and you know how they have an Arnold Palmer.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to call it a John Palmer.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, what will John Palmer think? I'm like, he'll be pleased. He'll be all right with it. It'll be fun. So, yeah, expect to see a John Palmer beer come out.
That'd be cool.
Because there's a John Daly, right, which is an Arnold Palmer with alcohol.
Oh, okay. Didn't remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're going to call it a John Palmer. It's kind of a combination of the two. That was fun. You know who else is fun? Our good friends at Brew Chatter.
Yes.
Josh and RJ, good folks. They're up near Reno. If you're ever passing through the Reno area, they're out in Sparks, real close there. There's a number of good breweries around them, good restaurants. It's a cool place to visit. And they got a really nice place there. They've got their own little bar, and they curate some nice beers on. If you ever get a chance, head on out there. But they also do a cracking job at their online store. You know, great customer service, you know, rapid responses, rapid shipping, good prices, good quality, good folks all around. So check them out. Brew Chatter at brewchatter.com, or our friends Josh and RJ, tell them we sent you. Send them an email and tell them thank you for helping sponsor the show. All right. Let's see here. What was the question I was going to? Fernando was asking, in addition to brewing beer, I recently started brewing kombucha. While trying to determine my ABV for it, I found forum posts and pages noting that you cannot actually accurately determine final gravity with a hydrometer for kombucha. Why is it different than beer? With some mixed fermented wild beers, you might get lactic acid and acetic acid generated, which is why is never mentioned in this case. Does lactic or acetic acid influence the hydrometer readings, not only for kombucha, but also for mixed fermented beers, where it won't be possible to determine the final gravity with the hydrometer? Thanks, Fernando.
Well, a hydrometer reading is always a hydrometer reading. It is a measure of the relative buoyancy of that solution versus plain water. And so, yeah, if you have some amount of acid in, yeah, that's going to affect what we would normally perceive as being, you know, an alcohol difference, or mainly a drop in sugar, with sugar being the primary component of wort, being the and residual carbohydrates still being a primary component of the resulting beer. In the case of kombucha, yeah, you have a little bit of acid. I wouldn't think substantial amounts. What you also may have, though, is suspended solids. And suspended solids will also affect hydrometer readings. I proved this to myself once with a solution of cornstarch in cold water. You know, very high gravity when it's all in suspension. You wait 30 minutes and that all settles to the bottom and you're right back at a gravity of zero, you know, for plain water. So, yeah, you watch your suspended solids when you're doing hydrometer readings.
There you go. And, you know, most hydrometer readings to determine alcohol, unless it's something very simple, it can be, you know, quite far off. There's calculators to help with that. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody comes up with a kombucha setting for one of these, you know, maybe the brewer's friend people want to throw in a kombucha setting or something. I don't know. I'm not sure how much difference it would make. But, you know, it's just in general, if you need to know precisely, you can send it out to a lab or you can do a distillation to determine if you have the tools to do a very precise measurements, you can do a distillation to tell you what the ABV is as well. All righty. Using glycol for a counterflow chiller and steam condenser. Okay, Jacob is asking, Hello, Jamil and John. I am very much a novice to the brewing world. Currently, I'm only doing 1 gallon to 5 gallon extract batches on my own, and I have only helped others do one barrel all grain recipes. I've been binge reading several of John's books and listening to your podcast every chance I get. My question is, can a glycol chiller be used in a counterflow chiller to cool the wort? Also, can it be used in a steam condenser during the boiling process if that condenser is made with internal tubing to avoid mixing? This would help reduce the amount of water that is used during the chilling and condensing process. Thanks again for sharing all of your great expertise and information. Thanks, Jacob. P.S. I don't have any of this equipment. I'm just asking. Yeah, you know, you can use glycol for that. The issue is, you know, it works. It's just, what are you doing with the glycol? If you're returning it to your reservoir that you've chilled down, because a glycol chiller sized big enough to handle a substantial, you know, a steam condenser or a counterflow chiller. The problem is that you'd have to size up that chiller massively. The way glycol chillers are generally sized is that you have a reservoir of, you know, 100 gallons or whatever it might be, 1,000 gallons. And your glycol chiller chills the liquid down over time and gets it nice and cold. And then you take some out, you know, for chilling down a fermenter, and it goes back in, and you know, all this happens throughout the day, but there's times when there's not so much load and the chiller is able to keep up. If you try and dump a ton of heat into the glycol at once, generally the chiller start running continuously, but you'll be at a much higher temperature, so you struggle with consistency that way. So it can be done, but kind of in a different way. So usually what happens on the chilling side is they will have a two-stage chiller. One set of plates is cooled by water, and that knocks it down to a general range. And then you use like the glycol to get it down into, you know, lager range or whatever fermentation range you want. And so you're not dumping the entire amount of heat into it, but you're just taking a little bit off. So that's how they do it with the two-stage chillers. On the steam condensers, generally it's kind of the same situation. If you use glycol for it, yeah, you'd be saving water, but you use an extreme amount of power. So generally what happens in commercial breweries is you use water, your regular brewing water, and you pass that through your steam condenser or your plate heat exchanger, and then you collect that water up as hot liquor, and then you use that hot liquor for your next brew. So that's how we do it at Heretic. We have a large cold liquor tank that we keep at, I think it's around 50 degrees Fahrenheit, or we might have warmed it up a little bit. To collect more water when we chill, so we have enough hot water for the next batch. So we'll run that through the heat exchanger. We'll cool the wort with that, and we collect it in our hot liquor tank, and then we use that for the future batches. We just got in a little 5-barrel system that has a steam condenser trap. So instead of venting this, you know, 8-foot, 10-foot tall brew plant out the roof, which is 33 feet, it just has a U that and a fan that pulls the steam down through a like a shotgun condenser, and we run water through that, and then the condensate just goes to the drain. So you know, I don't want to say water is cheap or abundant or anything like that. I know there's, you know, there's places that really struggle with water, but one of the things I was told by the czar of water in California was that, you know, water really isn't lost in a single use. You know, the water gets reused probably 7 or 8 times before it gets to the sea. And, you know, when you take in water, for example, in a brewery, and you use it for heating or cleaning or whatever, and it goes down the drain, that water gets processed again, gets put back into the system of, you know, rivers and delta and all that. And then people downstream pull more water out, and then they use it. And then after they're done, it goes back, you know, it gets treated again, it gets back in there. And eventually it makes its way down to, you know, the ocean. But, you know, a lot of it, the water that I brew with, and, you know, it ends up going down the drain, or when I pee and flush it, it all ends up down in John's neck of the woods eventually. And
they Southern California.
Right down there. Right. So I've probably peed in all of the beers made in Southern California at one time or another. So enjoy those beers. It's got a little bit of me in every drop. Now they process it out and it's back to drinkable water. But that's one of the reasons that it's not quite as critical. I mean, we need to conserve water, but you know, you'd end up, it's a little more efficient not to struggle with trying to chill those things rapidly. So that's,
yeah. I was going to say the heat capacity of water is greater than the glycol solution as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Glycol works great for fermenters where you're doing that slow temperature maintenance and a temperature, small temperature change. But the big reason why we use water to water heat exchangers for the chilling.
Mm-hmm. Micah asks, hey guys, hopefully you get to answer this by the end of the decade. As I near the end of fermentation, you suggest I raise the temperature in order to give the yeast an extra kick to finish off and get rid of unwanted substances. Should this temperature boost be forced by adding a heat source, or are we just turning off the chilling and letting the ambient room temperature and yeast activity do the raising?
Depends on where you live.
Right. And you know, what season it is, things like that. If the room's warm enough, you can certainly do that. It's very difficult if you don't time it right. Like in commercial fermenters, there's no heating element in there, and heating them can be very difficult on such a large source. Not a lot of pumping and things like that. So, for example, we raise the temperature on our lagers to get to a diacetyl rest and clean them up. And we do this by turning the cooling, adding less and less cooling to it. And if you miss a day, you've really kind of screwed the whole situation. It's going to take a lot longer. It's not going to hit that temperature that you wanted. So you need to be able to shut it off, you know, just the right point. Generally, in raising temperature on ferments, I always kind of look for that midpoint, the peak of fermentation, when it's just starting to slow, where you just barely notice that, oh, it looks like it's reached its peak and it's starting to get past its peak. Then I start to take the temperature control off and let it rise from there. And that always seemed to work well for me. How about you, John?
Yeah, that's essentially it. As you say, it's much difference of scale makes a big difference on what your capabilities are. Homebrewing situation here in Southern California, temperatures are generally warm. I can do a diacetyl rest simply by moving the fermenter to a warmer location or turning off or lowering the, or I should say raising the set point on the temperature controller. Other places, you may need to, say, use a two-stage controller in a fermentation box or area so you can actually apply warm air around the fermenter to help it heat, or a firm wrap or some other means of actively heating the fermenter.
I always use those, homebrewing, I always use those firm wraps. It's essentially a sheet of plastic, printed plastic, that is what's used in modern heating pads. And those work great because you can get really nice contact with the surface of the fermenter on that, and easy to run a controller on it. And I thought that those did an amazing job. One of the things I would do back in the day when I was brewing lagers was I would put the firm wrap on, I put a two-stage controller on it, and I would put it inside a refrigerator. And so I could, you know, lager, I could keep it in a nice controlled way, and I could raise the temperature, lower the temperature as much as I wanted. And it worked really well. I was very pleased with that and making lagers. I liked that better than a conical fermenter or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
All right. Let's take our last break. I've enjoyed this. We haven't done a Q&A in it seems like months.
Yeah.
We'll be back right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're enjoying doing another episode of Brew Strong. And,
yeah.
Let's see here.
Got a couple questions in the chat room for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Jimmy Jacobson asks, have you brewed a New Zealand Pilsner? Is there a certain hopping rate that is best for this style? I'm planning on brewing one in a couple of weeks with Raikau and Waiiti hops and putting it onto a yeast cake of a light lager that is fermenting now.
I have not.
I haven't either.
They just recently came out with that style designation. I'm not sure exactly what it means. Is that just a lager with New Zealand hops? Is that what it is?
I believe so. I'm unfamiliar with the particulars of the style as well. I think it's mainly a Pilsner with New Zealand hops. And so hopping rate would be similar to that of Pilsner?
I would say then that yes, I have brewed a New Zealand lager. Which is a collab with East Brother Brewing here in California. So we did on the 5-barrel plant, we just did, is Galaxy a New Zealand hop or is that an Australian hop?
Yeah, it's actually Australian.
Yeah. So I've made an Australian Pilsner then. Yes. we just did that. I think, you know, the concept is, you know, one of the things I find about that is that, you make a great lager, but when you use such expressive hops, such as Galaxy or some of the New Zealand hops that he mentioned, it just kind of overwhelms the lager character. So you can get away with a lot in the lager. And mm-hmm. I think, turns out great. I enjoy the flavor. So there you go. I guess I haven't brewed a New Zealand Pilsner yet. I'll put that on my list. Maybe there's some other aspect to it that we don't know, but that's because we don't know.
Total IBUs for a beer, that would be somewhere around maybe perhaps 30 to 40 IBUs for a New Zealand Pilsner, do you think? You're looking at, I'm thinking most lagers are in that one half BU to GU ratio. Pilsner being a hoppier style could approach that 3/4 ratio BU to GU, whereas say your IPAs are at the 1-to-1 range.
Okay. Everybody in the world is going through it. Overall impression, the pale, dry, golden-colored, cleanly fermented beer showcasing the characteristic tropical citrusy, fruity, grassy New Zealand type hops. Medium body, soft mouthfeel, smooth palate, and finish. With a neutral to bready malt base, provide the support for this very drinkable, refreshing, comfort beer. I did drink some when I was in New Zealand. Let's see. Yeah, aroma, appearance, straw deep cold in color. Most examples are yellow gold. Flavor, medium to high hop bitterness. Cleanly bitter, not harsh. Most prominent in the balance and lasting in the aftertaste. Comments. The hop aromatics often have a similar quality as many New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc wines, with tropical, fruity, grassy melon lime aromatics, often brewed as a hybrid style in New Zealand using neutral ale yeast at cool temperatures. Limiting the sulfur content of the finished product is important since it can clash with the hop character. Judging in competition styles is best within Category 12 Pale Commonwealth beer. Largely defined by the original created Emerson's Brewery in the mid-1990s. New Zealand Pilsner has expanded in the character as varieties of New Zealand hops have expanded. Pilsner malt, maybe a little bit of wheat malt, lager yeast, or very neutral ale yeast. Compared to German pils, not as crisp and dry in the finish with a softer, maltier presentation full body.
No numbers?
IBU 25-45, SRM 2-6, OG 44-56, FG 09-14, 4.5-5.8 ABV.
Okay, so yeah, that 3/4 to 1/1.
I've had Emerson's Pilsner. They have Croucher, Liberty, Panhead, Port Road, Pilsner. I think I had that one. So Pilsner with modern hops. Okay. Sounds good. Sounds delicious. There you go. So I have not brewed one. Let's see here. Time for one more?
Yeah. Do you have a question? I got a question from Tomas Sertautis.
Yeah, go ahead.
He's asking about the thickness amount of yeast on the bottom of the bottle affect aging of strong beers like barley wine. He says, I've got about 2 to 3 millimeters yeast layer on the bottom of the bottle and decided not to cold crash. With that much yeast still in suspension, didn't want to add fresh yeast while bottling.
Right.
Any pointers for him as far as getting rid of any yeast in the bottle or if this is too much?
Well, it does sound like a considerable amount of yeast. And generally, you don't want that amount of yeast. If you look at, for example, a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, you'll see that it's got a fine dusting across the bottom instead of, a thick. And generally, they add fresh yeast to do that. And, it depends on the barley wine, it depends on the strength of the barley wine, what yeast was used, and how durable it is. If it is, if the yeast is tired and it's high ABV, it's probably better to, chill the beer, get the yeast out, transfer off into a bottling bucket with a fresh dose of yeast and your priming sugar. And that way you're insured getting good, consistent carbonation. If you've already bottled and you've got 2 to 3 millimeters, one of the things you could do is just, if they've carbonated up well, I would just keep them cold. And then the yeast won't deteriorate as quick. One of the things you're trying to avoid is the yeast breaking down and giving you that meaty,
rubbery,
bottleized, rubbery yeast character. If you store cold once it's carbonated, that will help delay that from happening. And so, stored at fridge temperatures, probably be a year and you really won't notice those flavors. And, the best way to get the beer off the yeast, drink the beer, or you could, I've heard of people opening up bottles, pouring them into a keg, doing that whole thing. I don't know. Not for me. I'd just brew another beer and start over. But that's how I am.
Yeah. He says it was 10.5% alcohol, this barley wine. So that's a pretty substantial alcohol level. Yeah. I think what you said as far as chilling it to keep it as fresh as long as possible to avoid those autolysis flavors is good way to go.
Right. Okay. I think that's it. We'll wrap this up. And then if you're listening live, we're going to have Martin Cornell on in just a moment. And we'll be doing bird nails. So stay tuned. Until then, everybody, brew strong.
Brew strong, everyone.